That's it. We're recording.
Okay.
Ta-da. Cool. We did it, Joe.
Wait. How dare you?
You know, Zan says that all the time, too.
Does he really? Oh, yes. My God.
Yeah.
I forget what podcast I was listening to, and she said it. Oh, Scam Goddess. And I'm like, wow, this is just a thing that we're just going to let it ride. Okay. Well, hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. I don't know if that will remain in the podcast or not.
This is Thomas. Currently editing this podcast. Yes. Yes, it will.
Oh my God, where am I?
Yeah, we should just start that over.
Yeah. I forget how we opened the show. It says, hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Stephanie. Okay, that's right, right?
Wow. Yeah.
This is where the sleep deprivation comes in.
Yeah, right. Oh no.
Okay. Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lerzel.
I come to you from Roma, Italy. It's kind of awkward. I'm not on native land.
Yeah, they just turned into the people they are today,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's weird. I feel alone. I'm not on... I mean, I'm on someone's skull, but not... It's
sure, of course.
Indigenous, yeah. Theft...
I'm sure there was a lot of murder.
Oh,
that happened,
absolutely.
In Rome, right?
Yes. There were injustices that happened. Many, yes. Many of them. Land is so old. So, yeah.
Well, I am coming to you from Detroit, Michigan, where I record on land belonging to the Ottawa, Potawatomi, Ojibwe, and Wyandot nations.
Very nice. Those nations are some of many still very much out here doing their thing. We'd like to acknowledge that. This is the show.
Yes.
Heck yes. This is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government. We be drinking and we be swearing, y'all.
Fuck yes.
We back.
Mm-hmm. It's great to be back.
We back, baby.
Well, let's dive into, yes, this cocktail before we keep going. Yeah. So today we are drinking a cocktail called the South Side. This cocktail was really, really popular in the 1920s. My story is from the 20s today. The South Side is kind of like a cross between a gin gimlet with mint added to it or a gin-based mojito, but without soda water. It's also made pretty regularly with lemon juice rather than lime juice. The one I made, is yours with lime or lemon? I know when I texted you, I said you could do either.
You know, I don't know. We'll find out. I went to, I was telling Tux earlier that this was an adventure to find this cocktail. I had to go to four different bars in my neighborhood. I was refused service at three of them. So
because you wanted to take it with
no.
you?
No. Okay. So my neighborhood, just to back up a little bit, my neighborhood is very, I think the people are mostly from Nepal, and a lot of them have bars and cafes. There's like two on each block. So I'm like, I'll just go there. They're kind of like a bodega, but like a bar too, that serves coffee,
okay.
And, but also uh-huh. has like a full liquor supply, like behind near the coffee area. So I go in there and like, I'm telling them in my really terrible Italian, I ask, oh, can I take a drink to go? And they're like, no. And I'm like, no, you don't have cocktails, or no, I can't take a drink. And the first guy said that they were closed. And I looked around and I'm like, but there are people here. Okay. So, you know, I can take a hint. So I left.
Uh-huh.
So everyone in that bar was male. And the same thing happened in two other bars where I go in, all eyeballs are glued to me because I'm the only woman there. And I was, again, refused service in packed bars. So I'm like, okay, so these bars are just for the community, which is, you know, whatever. Now I get it. I see a pattern. They're not going to serve me alcohol. So I went to this really cheesy bar that I was hoping to avoid because it's so bright in there, like almost neon lights. Like I was just expecting to go to like this bodega, like, environment. Like, I don't want to be under harsh, like, you know, terrible lights. So I go in there and I'm greeted by this really attractive Italian man who kind of looks like Stanley Tucci. And he helps me out. He totally helps me out. He can speak English, which is helpful. And I finally got my cocktails and I just felt so out of place because it's like a date spot. And like, I am just being an American, being sloppy, like I had tennis shoes, like leggings, like I was not prepared for anyone to be looking at me, to be interrupting dates.
And you're like, can I take two cocktails to go, please?
Yeah, he put them in little cafe cups with tops. And he,
oh my God.
And I'm paying and he's like, would you like a pizza? I'm like, sir, I just want to take my cocktails, my shame, and leave. And he laughs. I laugh. He disappears and comes back with a pizza. So I got a free pizza right here.
A free pizza. Amazing.
I think he just saw how flustered I was and was just trying to help me out.
Here, feel better.
So I don't know what's in this cocktail. I was really just like trying to be invisible as they made my cocktails so I could just get them and leave.
Sure.
That's funny. Yeah, we'll find out if it's lemon or lime. But yeah, let me shut up.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a fun story. But so for whatever reason, this cocktail can be made with either lemon or lime juice. It's also made with gin, simple syrup, and mint. Just like a lot of cocktails that we have discussed on this show, researching the history of the Southside turned up a lot of contradictory information. So if its lack of clear identity is confusing, don't worry. So is its history.
I love it.
There are three very different yet very common origin stories that you'll find if you try and like Google this drink or the history of this drink. One story claims that it was invented in Chicago and named for the Southside neighborhood. Mm. And supposedly it was invented specifically to mask the flavor of bad quality gin during Prohibition. Another story says that it was invented several years before Prohibition at the Southside Sportsman's Club in Long Island, which was a private club where upper crusty Manhattanites would go to hunt and fish and drink mint juleps. And some people say that this cocktail may have evolved out of the mint juleps that they served there, but there's literally nothing that they have in common with a mint julep at all, other than the fact that there's mint in it. But like, it's a different spirit. There's citrus in that. It's like, they could not be any more different.
That's a weird one.
Yeah. And then another popular origin story says that it was invented at the 21 Club in New York. And while 21 definitely poured a fuck ton of Southsides during Prohibition, a recipe for a very similar cocktail called a Southside Fizz appeared in print in 1916, and the 21 Club didn't open until 1922.
Hmm.
So it's more realistic to say that the 21 Club popularized the Southside, but it didn't invent it. So the Southside Fizz, this sort of earlier recipe, is very similar to the one that we're drinking today, but it actually calls for both lemon and lime juice instead of one or the other, and it adds soda water, which this does not. But so let's take a little sip. Sipsy doodle.
Sipsy doodle. Cheers.
Cheers. It's lovely. Do you like it?
Lime. It's really nice.
Lime, yeah.
Yeah, it's very like subtle. Yeah. I like it.
It's like a gimlet. Yeah, it's like a gimlet, but there's mint in there, but it's not super minty. It's more sort of just like green and like herbal without being like mint. You know what I mean? Sort of grassy almost. Yeah.
I like it. It'd be
Me
great
too.
In the summertime. Yeah. Very refreshing.
Totally. Yeah, so that is the South Side. So let me dive right into this story here. So while the bulk of my story that I'm going to tell today takes place a few decades later, it all started on a family farm near Youngstown, Ohio, in the late 1800s. Most of it doesn't actually take place in Ohio, but some of it does.
When I was a kid at school, learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday.
But yeah, so it all started on a family farm near Youngstown, Ohio in the late 1800s when a young boy was accidentally stabbed in the leg with a pitchfork by a drunken farmhand. That boy's name was Wayne Wheeler, and the farmhand had been hired by his father to work on their family farm. One night, the farmhand had gotten super drunk, and a fight broke out between him and his boss and some of the other hired hands on the farm. And somehow, in the commotion, Wayne's leg caught a pitchfork. So, although his wounds healed pretty quickly, after that, he basically hated everything about alcohol and drunkenness for the rest of his life.
Okay. I didn't know where you were going to go with that. I'm like...
Yes,
he,
I know.
He hated pitchforks. He hated the farm.
he hated farmhands.
He hated farmhands. Hated Ohio.
Yeah.
Okay.
All true. Okay. Yeah. So today's episode, we're going to be talking about how in the 1920s, the government tried to force us all to quit drinking through the 18th Amendment and the Volstead Act.
Yes.
But I'm also going to be talking about a lesser known chapter of the Prohibition, talking about how when Americans learned that breaking the law was more fun than teetotaling, Wayne Wheeler convinced the United States government to poison one of the most popular sources for bootleg liquor in those years, leading to the deaths of thousands of Americans.
Oh my God.
Yes. True story.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, literally, like the government was like, well, these people are breaking the law. Let's kill them.
Oh my, that's dark.
So before I dive in, I would like to propose a toast to the knowledge that too much power in too few hands is a terrifying combination.
Oh my God. Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers to that.
That's very good. I love a gimlet. And I was like, this is not going to be an improvement on a gimlet because mint is like whatever. But I actually really like the sort of grassiness that it adds, or like herby freshness.
Yeah. It doesn't. I mean, I knew it wasn't going to subtract anything, but I like it, but I love the gimlet.
Yeah.
I love this too, though. I can love them both.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. I would have either or. So about 2 years ago, or maybe like, I don't know, a year and a half ago, I did a story on the show about the Whiskey Rebellion, and I followed it up with a mini-sode talking about how this country has basically always had a pretty serious drinking problem and how the rates of drinking have gone up and down over the centuries. So if you want to know more about just how much we were drinking before Prohibition, I would recommend revisiting that minisode. It's minisode 29. It's called American Drunks.
We were drinking a lot.
Yes, we were. And yeah, all I'm going to say right now is that in the early 1900s, before Prohibition, we really did have a serious drinking problem. It was not the most we have ever drank in this country. We have drank considerably more in years earlier than Prohibition. But either way, there was still a very good reason that the temperance movement was so popular at this
absolutely.
Time. So since bars and saloons were seen as basically male-only spaces.
You don't say. You don't say.
Yes. That's so funny. Just as was just illustrated to Stephanie in 2023.
In 2023. Three different bars said, no, ma'am, we don't want your money. Yeah.
Yeah, get out of here.
Wild.
Yeah. But so they were seen as male-only spaces. And since women didn't have control over their own finances or even their own lives, basically, at this point in history, one of the most common themes that was used to justify the idea of Prohibition was that unscrupulous men were going out and spending time in bars, and they were either drinking away all of their family's money at the bar, or drinking away their own health and eventually their lives, which would mean the family would be left destitute without a breadwinner, or they would be coming home drunk and getting like abusive and violent with their families. So women and children were seen as helpless victims when weak and sinful men lost the battle against the evils of alcohol. And for that reason, basically like the whole century leading up to Prohibition, two of the biggest and best organized groups that were trying to limit the sale and consumption of alcohol in this country were religious organizations and women's suffrage groups. One problem, though, in the temperance movement at that time was that no one really seemed to agree how this concept should work. Some believed that the solution should be basically like zero tolerance, ban all alcohol. But other people were like, well, you know, let's go a little bit more moderate than that. Like, let's just ban hard liquor.
Oh, okay.
But like beer and wine is okay. Most people were on that team. There were not that many people that were on the ban all liquor bandwagon. Other people thought maybe we just like limit where bars can be located or liquor stores can be located so that they're not like in residential areas or working class neighborhoods. But there was another problem going on in this movement. Since the temperance movement had so many followers from so many different walks of life, everyone kind of had different priorities. Mm. Along with the idea of temperance, a lot of these different groups that were a part of this movement were pushing agendas like vegetarianism, forest conservation, or public-owned utilities.
So wait, temperance just means not drinking, right? Or like avoiding sin? Feels very biblical.
It's like trying to temper the amount of alcohol that people are consuming.
It's always alcohol.
Basically.
Got it.
Okay. Yeah. Or at least used in this context. Yeah. It was made up of a bunch of smaller groups, the temperance movement.
Okay.
And some of these groups were vegetarians. Some were pushing for public-owned utilities or expanding the power of the post office.
Random.
All sorts of things. Yeah.
I love it, but weird.
It basically just like watered down their total message because there were so many different groups with different ideas and different agendas. But that all changed when a scrawny, bookish man named Wayne Wheeler got involved. Now, of course, the story of how Prohibition passed is way, way, way too complex and just like too big of a story for me to cover everything and everyone that was involved today. But suffice it to say that Wayne Wheeler played an undeniable role. When he died, the New York Herald Tribune wrote, quote, "Without Wayne Wheeler's generalship, it is more than likely we should never have had the 18th Amendment."
Wow.
Yeah. So in 1893, as he was finishing up college, he went to Oberlin, Wheeler joined the recently formed temperance group called the Anti-Saloon League. And the Anti-Saloon League eventually turned into the most effective political pressure group this country had ever seen, basically because Wayne Wheeler was driving the ship. The temperance movement already had hundreds of thousands of followers across the country at this point, but Wheeler believed that rather than this hodgepodge of moral and social issues, the ASL needed to be laser focused on one issue and one issue only: the absolute abolition of alcohol from American life.
Wow.
Get rid of it. Abolish all the pitchforks.
Wow. I mean, he's smart sticking to one, like, I mean, wild idea. That's how you can push a message.
Exactly. As we're seeing today.
Yeah.
So initially the plan was that the ASL was going to try to get individual states to ban the manufacture and sale of booze one by one, one state at a time, until every single state was dry because of their influence. All they thought they had to do was harness the members of the ASL and their votes to put pressure on politicians to do their bidding, essentially. Any politician who supported anti-liquor laws could count on the Anti-Saloon League's support, while any politician who didn't could count on their focused, organized, and vocal opposition.
How did they get money? Do we know?
I mean, people were donating. Yeah.
Trying to prevent good times. Okay, cool.
Yes, exactly. Yes, they hated good times. The show.
Yes.
Yeah, so because Wheeler had like kind of just graduated, he decided, like, I'm in Ohio, I'm going to test the ASL's methods in Ohio.
Uh-oh.
And thanks to his background as a lawyer, he understood how politics worked. So the ASL used a combination of lawsuits, speeches, telegram campaigns, and public demonstrations, which he called petitions in boots. And before long, the ASL had control over the Ohio legislature. They had opposed 70 sitting politicians from both parties in Ohio, and they defeated every single one that they went up against. And once their hand-picked replacements were voted into place, they pushed a bill that put the power of the saloons directly in voters' hands at the local level.
So basically,
if Cleveland wanted to be wet, Cleveland would be wet. If Dayton wanted to be dry, Dayton would be dry.
You know, that shit still exists.
Really? I did not know that.
Yes. My parents live in a dry county. Yes.
You have Wayne Wheeler to thank for that and the Anti-Saloon League. I didn't know that. That's crazy.
I wish the pitchfork hit him in the dick. It would probably make it even worse. But
yeah, seriously. Yeah. But yeah, so when this bill passed, Ohio's governor pushed for changes to the language in the bill before he would sign it into law. And Wheeler was like, oh no, she better don't.
Oh no. And, oh no, she better don't. Wait, who said that? What's that? RuPaul. Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah.
But yeah, so he was like, no, we're not doing this today. Not today, Satan. And so the ASL was like, okay, I guess we're ready to try and flex our muscles on somebody bigger than these little small-time Ohio politicians. We're going to take down the fucking governor of Ohio.
Oh, boss.
And this was an election year that he did this. And later that year, his political career was over. And the ASL was like, okay, we're ready. We're ready to take this outside of Ohio and keep going bigger and bigger.
That's impressive. I mean, terrifying, but like, wow.
Yeah, exactly.
Like
yeah,
in one cycle, they got him out. Like,
yeah. In like a matter of months. It was the same year. Yeah.
I'm like glad people don't know about, like, I'm glad the right, like, isn't replicating whatever he's doing.
Apparently, there is a political movement called Wheelerism, that this is like still, people still talk about Wheelerism as a strategy
today.
It seems
very successful already, but yeah, I'm going to let you go on.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, that's why single issue voters and like, and you know, politicians who focus on these like boogeymen kind of topics are so popular and so successful, because all you have to do is it's all smoke and mirrors. You know what I mean? I mean, in Wayne Wheeler's case, he really did care about the issue that he was pushing for, rather than like politicians who want to villainize drag queens or something, who are really just trying to get you to focus on drag queens when there's something else going on. But yeah, so the ASL decided to move beyond Ohio. And for the next few years, they were pretty successful. They had some success in the South, especially. Mm-hmm. But then in 1913, the 16th Amendment enacted a national income tax in the United States. And the ASL saw this as a golden opportunity for them. Because up until that point, the federal government depended on liquor taxes for as much as 40% of their annual income.
What?
Seriously. Oh. 40% of the United States government's income was coming from liquor taxes.
Were they drinking that much?
I mean, we were drinking a lot and there was no income tax.
Okay, there we go. You okay, know. There was no, okay, so it's like by comparison.
There was no income tax until then. And like, you know, infrastructure was much smaller and easier to pay for it. Seriously, yeah. So politicians who were opposed to prohibition were like, no, we can't get rid of booze because the government needs this tax money. But then when income tax was enacted, the ASL was like, now what, bitch?
Ha! Checkmate.
Yeah, exactly. So the ASL was like, all right, we're abandoning this state-by-state bullshit strategy, and we're going to focus instead on a national ban on alcohol through a constitutional amendment.
Stop it! Wow.
They're like, no, we're going fucking big. We're shooting for the moon here.
Audacity. I wish I had just like an ounce of that audacity. Just like the smallest fraction, like 1/256th fraction of that audacity to be like, we're gonna add an amendment to the Constitution.
We're gonna amend the Constitution because I got stabbed in the leg with a pitchfork when I was little.
How old was he again when this happened?
I don't know. He was little. I don't know exactly how old, but he was young.
Okay.
Like a child.
But like,
you know,
not too young. Like he clearly remembers and like was scarred.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, yeah, yes. Yes.
Okay.
He just said, yeah, yeah, yes.
Oh, I love it.
Yes. But yeah, so like a constitutional amendment requires a 2/3 majority in both houses of Congress and ratification from at least 36 states. This was a big ask, a tall order. The other thing, though, is like most people didn't actually want an all-out ban on alcohol. People were, into the idea of temperance, but they didn't really, I don't think they really realized how extreme the ASL's initiative would be. They were just like, yeah, it's the temperance movement. People are fucking shit up because they're drunk all the time. I'm all for it. So in the years between the passage of the 16th Amendment in 1913 and the 18th Amendment in 1919, Wheeler focused on teaming up the ASL's voting bloc and their like power with other special interest groups to make them all like exponentially more powerful. Most notably, he signed the ASL up with the women's suffrage movement to help them fight for the rights of white women to get the rights of to vote. And actually both amendments, the 18th Amendment and the 19th Amendment, where white women did get the right to vote, passed in the same year in 1919. Because these two organizations were like, yeah, we're going to do this together.
With their powers combined like Captain Planet.
Yeah, yeah. But along with the suffragists, the ASL also won the support of social reformers, evangelical clergy, and labor unions. Hmm. They aligned themselves with progressives that were trying to uplift urban immigrants. But at the same time, they also teamed up with the KKK, whose anti-liquor sentiment was rooted in hatred of Catholic immigrants, especially Irish and Italians. And in the South, the ASL used imagery of a black man with a bottle in one hand and a ballot in the other to scare the fucking pants off of Southern racists.
I was just waiting for the racism. I'm like, I mean, this is a story. I mean, of course it is. Especially that era. You know, the 20s, for sure. The teens.
So one region at a time, one politician at a time, they used their voting power to collect every single politician they needed to gain control of Congress, both houses of Congress. And they did it in like 6 years between 1913 and 1919.
That's impressive. Again, I'm just like, I just didn't know that you could move policy so quickly. Like, I had never seen a use case.
It moved so fast.
This should never happen because it's...
I know. It's terrifying. Yeah.
Wow.
So they got control of both houses of Congress, but getting 36 states to ratify the amendment was seen as sort of like an even taller order. But then Wheeler got the idea to use anti-German sentiment during World War I to vilify beer brewers.
Knows how to pivot.
Yeah. He sure does. Yes. One dry Wisconsin politician said, quote, "We have German enemies across the water and we have German enemies in this country too. And the worst of all our German enemies, the most treacherous, the most menacing, are Pabst, Schlitz, and Miller."
That's hilarious. And it's sad that I did not know Miller was German, but obviously, Okay.
So once they submitted this amendment or the idea for this amendment, it only took 13 months to get approval from all 36 state legislatures. 13 months, less than half as long as it took to ratify the Bill of Rights.
Oh my God. Oh no. Okay.
Yeah. So the 18th Amendment was embedded into the Constitution on January 16th, 1919, and was scheduled to go into effect in exactly 1 year from that date at the beginning of 1920. I almost said 2020.
Just imagine if this guy was like pushing for healthcare. We'd have it.
Come on. We'd have it. Do some good in the world, sir. Like, you got stabbed with a pitchfork. You don't want healthcare?
Thank you.
Right? It's so fucking wild. So before the ASL really celebrated, though, they got their, you know, they got the amendment passed, but there was a problem. The language in the 18th Amendment was really vague and it didn't have any teeth in this amendment. It stated that the manufacture, sale, transportation, or importation of quote unquote intoxicating liquors would be prohibited once the law went into effect. But that's basically all it says. It never defined exactly what an intoxicating liquor was or how strong one had to be prohibited. Mm. And it also never mentioned how the law would be enforced and what kind of punishment there would be for, you know, violating this law. So the ASL knew that they needed to act really fast and pass another law before the 18th Amendment went into play in a year, just to make sure that it would be enforced once it was, you know, live, essentially. So you'll never guess who was put in charge of drafting this new law.
Mr. Pitchfork?
Yeah, Wayne Wheeler.
Wow.
Wayne Wheeler himself got right to work writing the Volstead Act, which would clarify the meaning of intoxicating liquors and specify the means of enforcing the Prohibition Amendment. And while he was at it, he did also decided to give himself control over the Bureau of Prohibition and make it so that any changes to the liquor codes had to have his approval.
Wow, this guy is so serious about this.
Yes, yes.
This is like the moment he's been waiting for, you know?
Literally,
like he had a vision board. And this was on it. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. He had a Pinterest board and it was all just like pictures of booze with slashes through them.
Oh my God. Wow. Wow.
And the occasional pitchfork.
Wow. Just wow.
Yeah. So thanks to Wheeler, the Volstead Act defined intoxicating liquor as any liquid over 0.5% alcohol by volume, which is nothing. Oh, is it?
Okay. I'm like, I don't know.
It's nothing. Yeah. Very few people who supported the temperance movement had ever. It's like kombucha.
Oh, fuck. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nothing.
So very few people who had supported the temperance movement had ever wanted or expected this. But thanks to Wayne Wheeler, the Volstead Act meant that any alcoholic beverage stronger than kombucha would be illegal.
Wow. In the United States. What have we done?
I know. Yeah. And so President Woodrow Wilson vetoed the Volstead Act, but the Senate and the House, who are still scared to death of the power of the ASL, were like, nah, we got this. And they overrode his veto.
I like to think that it was Edith.
Yeah, it probably was. Yeah. So, yeah, even though most Americans thought that there should be a differentiation between hard liquor and beer and wine, Congress passed the Volstead Act. And in January of 1920, the United States went dry. And so I think this is a good time to take a little break, yeah. A break-sipoo.
Yeah. Wow. Unreal. Yeah.
It's wild.
The speed of it all. And the so severity. Fast. Like.
Too fast, too furious. Yes.
Okay. So that's the name of this episode.
Amazing. Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
so good.
Welcome to Hashtag History. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah. And if you're a history nerd,
or even a history hater,
this is the podcast for you.
Even if history was your least favorite subject in school, we can guarantee you will like this podcast because we talk about all the things that your history textbooks did not.
Things like how the Bonnie Prince Charles and his Jacobite uprising was a bit of a disaster.
Yeah, or how the Pharaoh Akhenaten was so disliked by Egyptians that they literally purged his name from nearly all of their records and pretended like he had never existed.
And we do all of this while drinking and rating a custom-made cocktail specific to that week's topic.
So grab a drink, take a seat, and hang out with us each week as we learn all about history's greatest stories of controversy,
conspiracy,
and corruption.
So we're back. My drink is very wet. sorry to those in the United States in the 1920s who couldn't get a wet drink. So yeah, after January of 1920, with the evils of alcohol abolished from the United States, the temperance movement promised that families would be made stronger, weak men would come to Jesus, and crime would, albeit, disappear. But that's not exactly what happened. It's not really. No.
Yikes. Yeah.
Yeah. So not only did criminalizing alcohol fail to strengthen the nation's moral fiber.
You don't say. We weren't all saved by Jeebus?
It also completely undermined America's respect for the government and the Justice Department or justice system. Mm. And people who had happily obeyed the laws of this country for their entire lives suddenly realized that laws that they didn't believe in were meant to be broken.
Oh, I love that for them. That's a good realization.
It was literally overnight.
Now the country is was my like, time to do crime. Yeah.
Yeah. How about fuck the government? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, crime is fine.
How about these nuts?
So everyone was in on the action. Winemakers started shipping grape juice concentrate with labels on the packages with detailed instructions on how to avoid accidentally breaking the law by allowing the grapefruit juice to ferment into wine at home.
Wow.
They're like, here's this grapefruit juice that you bought. Don't turn it into wine. And here's the instructions on how not to
do
that.
Don't you do this thing I just showed you how to do. Don't do it.
Uh-huh. Don't you do it. Oh, no. Do it this way. Yeah, right. Don't do it that way, though. Yeah. So rather than keeping men out of the saloons, Prohibition actually brought women into the speakeasies and made co-ed drinking popular in a way that it had never been before. Like, bars and saloons were male-only spaces, but speakeasies, there was women there, a lot of women. It was like, it was...
So women started drinking totally because, like, it was like bad to do, or they were already drinking before?
They would drink at home and stuff, but they didn't go out. They weren't going to the bars, you know? But then when speakeasies happened, it was like nightlife developed.
Oh, I see.
All of a
sudden.
Got
it. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Like, Prohibition changed American culture. And I've taken a lot of this out of my outline, but I am getting it back in. Like, so many things were changed permanently because of Prohibition. Like, at-home dinner parties were not a thing before Prohibition. Mm. But people were like, I got a bottle of wine. I, like, bought it from a smuggler. Let's have a party at home and make dinner. Yeah.
Okay.
Like, so many things changed. Speedboat design changed because smugglers were trying to, like, outrun the police in harbors and shit. Like, it is wild the number of things that were changed because of this.
That's incredible. It, like, made boat engineering, or, like, it made boats faster.
Yeah, literally. But yeah, so speaking of these speakeasies, thanks to the suddenly huge numbers of Americans that were willing and eager to break the law, organized crime almost instantly exploded in cities across the country. Yeah. Like, the mob wasn't shit before Prohibition, and all of a sudden they ran the shit in, like, every fucking big city across the country.
Really? So they weren't big before Prohibition? That was,
I mean, they were around, but they were kind of small potatoes. They weren't doing, they were not doing things on the scale that they were doing once everyone wanted to crime.
Yeah. Yes.
People are out here criming in these streets.
They're criming. I'm not mad at they're criming at all.
No.
They're performing crimes, you know?
Yes, they were performing crimes. Yeah. And if police weren't speakeasy patrons themselves, not just the police, but, like, judges, city council members, mayors, everyone was going to the speakeasy. But if the police weren't going to the speakeasy themselves, they were usually more than happy to at least accept bribes to look the other way. And even Wayne Wheeler's own Prohibition agents were accepting bribes. And in many cases, they were even more crooked than the cops, because most of them knew that the best bribes came from the biggest crime bosses. So they just had to make it look like they were still doing their jobs by cracking down on, like, small town moonshiners or independent speakeasies that weren't run by the mob, or, like, the random rum runner that had, like, a little bit, you know? All of which actually made organized crime even more powerful, because Prohibition agents were taking out the competition for the mob. Obviously, this wasn't the case with everyone. Of course, some agents actually did try to do their jobs and do them well. There was, like, Elliot Ness and the Untouchables. There were Prohibition agents that really were trying to crack down on illegal alcohol. But for the most part, people were like, I like money. You have money. I don't care if you drink. You know what I mean?
Your drinking isn't hurting me.
I didn't get stabbed in the leg with a pitchfork when I was a kid. And, you know, a lot of Americans also did completely give up drinking, or at least try for the first couple of years. They were like, no, it's illegal. We probably shouldn't do it anyways, because, like, bad shit was happening. People were too drunk.
Yeah, people were too drunk.
So a lot of people really did try.
Or at least cut back, right?
And it... Yeah. And at first, the rate that we were drinking really dropped super drastically. But then over the first couple of years, that rate started to climb again. Wow. And by, like, the mid-1920s, it was pretty high again. It wasn't to where it was before, but it was
close.
Yeah. I mean, because it was a lot harder to get liquor. You could find it if you wanted to find it, you could find it, but it was a lot more expensive, and it was kind of, like, dangerous and seedy, and you don't know where it was coming from. I mean, I should say here that, like, the rich, this didn't affect the rich. No one was arresting, was going into, like, the Vanderbilts and raiding their wine cellars. Yeah. No one, you know,
Harding was drinking in the White House. Like,
exactly. Yeah. This only affected mostly poor people who lived in cities. Yeah. people in the country were already brewing their own moonshine and shit, so they weren't even really affected in the way that people in cities were. This affected poor people in cities.
That's unfortunate.
Or middle class people in cities. But yeah, so as these rates of drinking started to climb again, Wayne Wheeler was fucking
pissed. Of course he was.
Like, no fucking sir, we're not doing this. So by the mid-1920s, booze was pretty easy to come by if you knew where to look. At one point, New York City's police commissioner estimated that there were 32,000 illegal establishments selling liquor in New York City. 32,000 in New York City alone.
That's outrageous.
Yeah. I mean, they weren't all speakeasies. A lot of it was probably like somewhere like the corner store where you could be like, you know, a bottle. Yeah. But still.
Wow.
But so where do you think most of this booze was coming from? Like, I don't know if how much you know. I always had heard of like bathtub gin and this kind of idea of like, but I never really knew where it was coming from or what
was it coming from. Canada? Like,
some of it was, a lot of it was.
I would assume at least the stuff from New York, like it's not hard to run it down.
Cities on the border with Canada and or close to the border with Canada and cities on coasts. It was a little bit easier for those kinds of cities to get, you know, smuggled liquor. But places that weren't on the coast still had to find a way to get, and a lot of, you know, New Yorkers also were not drinking smuggled liquor because smuggled liquor was safer, but it was a lot more expensive.
Oh, okay. So they were making it themselves? Is that what's happening?
Yeah. So some of it was being smuggled in. Some was being made in like country moonshine stills and being shipped into the cities. Some of it was being brewed at home, like the people that were buying the grape juice. Just because, you know, their kids like Welch's.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Some people were doing that. But in the first several years of Prohibition, most, like the vast majority of the liquor we were drinking was being distilled from other legal sources that were never meant for human consumption.
Oh, no.
Yes. The Volstead Act made an exception for industrial manufacture of alcohol that was used to make things like cleaning agents, fuels, paints, perfumes, that kind of stuff.
Oh, no.
But bootleggers learned how to sort of refine this industrial alcohol into something drinkable, and then you would mix it with strongly flavored mixers, lime juice and sugar and mint to cover up the fact that it tasted like fucking perfume or paint or whatever.
Whoa.
And then they would sell it in speakeasies. That's why a lot of Prohibition drinks have such strongly flavored mixers, because this stuff tasted like shit.
I just thought it was because it was people were making it and they were bad at making it.
That's kind of what I've always assumed too. That's sort of the story that we're told as kids, like when we do learn, you know, for like 2 days when we learn about Prohibition in school. That's kind of how it's presented, but that is not the case. What they were doing in these bathtubs is after it was distilled, they would put in juniper and flavoring agents to make it taste like gin.
Yeah.
But it was never brewed as gin. It was brewed as fucking alcohol to be made into perfume.
Whoa. And they were working with the factories. They got like things fell off a truck.
A lot of it was being stolen. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Stuff was falling off of trucks left and right. Stolen and redistilled industrial alcohol was the primary source of liquor in this country.
Wow,
and
the government actually estimated. Source. That's wild.
By far.
A little.
The government estimated that by the mid-1920s, some 60 million gallons of industrial alcohol were being stolen every single year. And furious that people were breaking his law that he devoted his life to passing, Wayne Wheeler thought of a solution: poison the well. Producers of industrial alcohol had been adulterating their product to make it undrinkable for years. This was already happening before Prohibition. Okay. In 1906, because there was such a heavy tax on alcohol, because the government needed that money, in 1906, the government agreed that industrial producers of alcohol would not have to pay that hefty tax on potable spirits if they added chemicals to their product to make it undrinkable.
That makes sense.
So that's why these like bootlegger chemists had to figure out how to like redistill this booze into something drinkable. However, Wheeler wanted to make sure that this industrial alcohol was being adulterated in a way that would be as deadly as possible.
Wow.
So he started adding, well, not him personally, but his agents started adding a laundry list of new poisons.
So they were allowed to just add poisons or like advise?
They were sanctioned by the government to do this. And it was a law that industrial producers of alcohol had to let the government in to do this.
Whoa.
Or they had to do it themselves with government oversight, okay. You know.
And there was oversight before to just make it undrinkable?
They were just like, yeah, it can't be drinkable. It doesn't necessarily have to be like deadly. In some cases it was deadly if you just drank it on its own. But it was like stuff that was very easy to distill out. Alcohol boils at a very specific temperature in a still. And so like the chemists were figuring out like, yeah, if there's this in it, we can boil it at this temperature. And
yeah,
like,
sift out the paint or whatever. You know.
Exactly. Yeah. So these well-paid chemists who were working for the bootleggers, even after Wayne Wheeler started adding even more poisons and different shit to the liquor, they quickly learned how to redistill this liquor to get at least most of these poisons evaporated out. Like, and this is why, you know, a lot of people were afraid to go to the speakeasy because it could be dangerous. You didn't know what was in the liquor that you were drinking. You didn't know where it came from. But, you know, a lot of people just wanted to have a good time.
Yeah, this is why drugs need to be legal so they can be safe.
Yeah.
Because people, we've never existed in a drug-free society. That is a myth. Wow, this is like, I mean, those chemists were heroes. People were having a good time and they were trying to protect human life.
Yeah, I mean, they were very rich heroes at this point too. But
I mean, they are providing a service that not many people can do. Yeah.
So this basically led to like a war between the Prohibition Bureau and these chemists. The Bureau kept changing the formulas of poisons.
Wow, they were really trying to make sure people.
They literally wanted to make sure that people would die because they wanted people to think that, oh, it's dangerous. I'm not going to drink.
Okay.
So they kept changing the formula of poisons to make sure that it would be fatal. And the chemists kept learning how to distill out at least most of these chemicals. Eventually, the Prohibition Bureau had over 70 different formulas with different combinations of poisons in their rotation. And there was kind of no way for bootleggers to know exactly which formula was in which booze.
So scary.
Yeah. And there wasn't really an easy way to know if you distilled it all out, depending on what was in it in the first place, until somebody drank it. And then it was like, see if they're okay. And okay, we can sell it now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So a lot of people died of trial and error.
Of course.
Yeah. Critics of Wheeler's plan suggested that the Prohibition Bureau could just add really disgusting flavoring agents instead of poisons to make sure that people just wouldn't want to drink this stuff because it was too fucking gross. And, you know, there were things that they could put in that couldn't be boiled out or distilled out. But Wheeler was like, no, if this shit isn't going to kill people, I don't want to hear it. I don't want nothing to do with it. These people are breaking my fucking law.
Wow, what a little tyrant.
Yeah. So some of the chemicals that they used included, I have a whole fucking laundry list here, kerosene, gasoline, brucine, benzene, cadmium, iodine, zinc, mercury.
Yeah, these are heavy metals.
Ether.
Oh, no.
Yes. Formaldehyde, chloroform, camphor, carbolic acid, and acetone.
Oh, my God.
Yes. But the most common ingredient and the most highly toxic was methyl alcohol, which is also called wood alcohol, which evaporated at the exact same temperature as potable alcohol, so it was almost impossible to distill out. Wood alcohol tastes and smells a lot like regular alcohol, but when ingested, it breaks down into a form of formaldehyde in the body.
Oh my God, fuck.
Drinkers wouldn't notice the difference at first because it produces a sort of short-lived inebriation, quickly followed by a kind of hangover.
Okay.
If you're lucky and you only drink a little bit, you might experience only a headache, dizziness, nausea, or severe abdominal pain.
Oh, no.
But if you drank too much and you are unlucky, you could experience hallucinations, mania, blindness, paralysis, coma, or death. At the end of 1926, a batch of liquor with an especially high concentration of wood alcohol circulated in New York City. On Christmas Eve, Bellevue Hospital treated a rush of poisoning victims. It all started with a man who stumbled into the emergency room shaking and screaming, scared to death, that Santa Claus was chasing him with a baseball bat because he was hallucinating from the effects of wood alcohol. He died very soon after that. And 60 more victims followed on Christmas Day, 8 of whom died.
Wow.
And over the next 2 days, 23 more people died and dozens more were permanently blinded.
Wow.
Yeah. Horrified, New York's chief medical examiner issued a public statement. Quote, "The government knows it is not stopping drinking by putting poison in alcohol. It knows what the bootleggers are doing with it, and yet it continues its poisoning process, heedless of the fact that people determined to drink are daily absorbing that poison. Knowing this to be true, the United States government must be charged with the moral responsibility for the deaths that poisoned liquor causes." So, however, when he heard about this, when Wayne Wheeler heard how many people were dying from this formula that had a higher concentration of wood alcohol, rather than shock or remorse, in 1927, Wayne Wheeler ordered that industrial distillers had to boost the percentage of wood alcohol in every batch going forward.
Oh, my.
He's like, this is the golden ticket. This is what we've been looking for. How did we not know this sooner?
Wow.
This is how we're going to kill more people.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Okay.
He told the New York Times.
Wow, that's really dark.
Yeah. He told the New York Times, "The government is under no obligation to furnish the people with alcohol that is drinkable when the Constitution prohibits it. The person who drinks this industrial alcohol is a deliberate suicide. It's not my fault.
This guy sucks.
You killed yourself." Yeah, totally.
You unknowingly killed yourself having a good time. Ugh.
But yeah, so he was like, yeah, it's not my fucking problem. If you want to kill yourself, that's on you. So in New York City in 1926, there were reportedly 400 people who died from consuming poison booze, just in New York City in 1926. In 1927, after increasing the wood alcohol requirement, that figure almost doubled.
Oh my God. Of course it did.
Yeah. And again, this was just in New York City in 1 year. And those are only the reported deaths.
Oh.
And a lot of people were ashamed of what they were doing and weren't going to the hospital.
Oof. So do they have real numbers? Probably not.
No. It's impossible to know the real numbers. One columnist wrote, quote, "The 18th Amendment is the only amendment with a death penalty." In 1927, Popular Science magazine wrote, quote, "Uncle Sam has been on trial before the bar of public opinion, charged for no less of a crime than willful and premeditated murder."
Wow. I mean, yeah.
So like people knew what was going on. People knew that the government was fucking murdering people.
Wow.
It's wild that we don't know about this today and people don't talk about this.
Yeah. It's really like really, really bad.
I know.
For the US, they were just like, I'm like shook.
Yeah.
I mean, just so brazen. And the fact that this guy could just keep running with this wood alcohol, even though it's killing people, and being like, yes, this is
the way. This is what we have to do now. Yeah.
Oh.
And the government's like official attitude towards these deaths was basically like, sucks for them. They shouldn't be doing that.
So this guy is ahead of what? Like,
he's not an elected official. He doesn't really, like, he's kind of sort of oversees the Bureau of Prohibition, but like he kind of put himself into that position. Like he was not appointed. He was not elected.
So he has no boss. He's just like, but somehow the head of it.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa, yeah. That's scary.
Yeah.
This man, like he has done the impossible so many times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. One Prohibition official said that drinkers on the fringes of society were, quote, dying off fast from poison hooch. And that if the results of these deaths was a sober America, a good job will have been done.
Okay, so eugenics type of like, uh-huh. Okay, this is helping.
These people are this, like, they're a drain on society because they're Yeah.
So we just need a rich white woman to die, and then they can change.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But rich people were not drinking this poison shit.
Oh, of course. Of course they were getting the safe.
They were getting the smuggled stuff from.
Oh, okay. So, okay. Damn. Okay.
Yeah. Rich people were not going to speakeasies and drinking this poison.
But rich people they knew. Were going to speakeasies, right?
They were going to speakeasies, but they weren't. I mean, maybe they'd have like a drink, but I feel like they knew to probably either get drunk beforehand or
they probably had little, bring it with them. Yeah, exactly. They
flasks or something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. By the time Prohibition was repealed at the end of 1933, most sources estimate that the total national death toll was around 10,000 people. Over the years of Prohibition.
Wow.
But some people believe that that number was much higher, much higher. Yeah. Could actually be as high as 50,000.
Yeah.
50,000 Americans like murdered by the government because they broke the law.
Wow. That's really bad.
Wayne Wheeler died of heart failure in 1927.
I was just thinking like this man kind of needs to die because I think that's the only thing that will stop him.
Yeah. This was 6 years before Prohibition ended. Eventually, though, like the bootleggers kind of figured out how to brew their own booze.
Oh, okay.
Because they didn't want to kill off their own patrons and shit. So like after 1927, when things got really poisoned and like it was really dangerous, they were like, no, we got to figure something else out.
Yeah.
And eventually the industrial alcohol stuff kind of subsided and they were making their own. But like they didn't stop drinking.
No.
You know what I mean? But yeah, so he died 6 years before Prohibition was repealed. A biography published the year after his death, written by a colleague of his, described him as a man who, quote, controlled six Congresses, dictated to two presidents, held the balance of power in both Republican and Democratic parties, supervised a federal bureau from the outside without official authority, and was recognized by friend and foe alike as the most masterful and most powerful single individual in the United States.
I agree with all of that. Yeah.
Yes. I think mostly, though, he needs to be remembered as a power-hungry mass murderer.
Absolutely. Yeah. He was a son of a bitch. I wish he would have lived long enough to see that everyone could drink again. And like,
I know. That's like, seriously. That would have been, to see Prohibition repealed.
Delicious. Like, die that, like, a few days after.
I know.
Like, exactly. Sobbing.
Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of things that led to the repeal of Prohibition. I mean, nobody was paying attention to the law at that point anyways. It was 1933 that it was repealed, which is wild that it was in place for 13 entire years. The government, you know, tax revenue was coming in from income tax, but like we were going into the Depression and nobody had any money anymore. So that revenue started to dry up and the government was like, we kind of need that booze tax money again. So,
why. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the biggest reasons. Yeah.
I'm not mad at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. What a son of a bitch.
I know.
He was so good at his job, whatever that was, the job that he gave himself.
that he made up for himself. Yeah.
He's
terrifying.
He's like, maybe in development.
People are like, Wayne, you're fucking killing me or killing people. He's like, marry me.
Oh my God. Oh, that is exactly what he's doing. Oh, that was really good. Whoa. That was a ride. I was not prepared for it.
Right.
The government killed so many people.
So like,
no one was watching
people.
Him.
Literally
like, no one cared, I guess.
No, but the government knew this was happening. There were so many different officials involved and like nobody was telling them, hey, you can't kill
people. People were dying and it was eugenics and like, oh, these people are a drain on the society anyways.
Exactly. Yep. They're drunks. Yeah. Meanwhile,
the whole thing was pitched as like, oh, this will preserve the family. This will make
exactly. This is
it killed
good for our morality. Yeah. Let's murder people.
Oh my God. What a terrible. But thank you for that story because I had no clue.
I know
about the industrial alcohol thing at all. I thought everyone was just like trying to be their own bootlegger and that's why booze was so bad.
That's kind of how we're taught the story.
I feel like
but
we're
like
not
that,
taught this because then like we would learn that the government
we would know from a young age
killed people.
Yeah. Yeah, the government don't give a fuck about you, especially if you're poor.
Thank you for sharing that story. It was really,
of course,
really fucking good. My drink is just mint leaves, like dried up.
Oh, I better. I've got a little drop left. Let me.
I had one drop and it was not enough left. My drink has been empty. I would it's slurp, slurp, but I have nothing to slurp and I can't slurp. Damn it. I was just going to say, I can't slurp the air. So America's history is juicy. We just add gin, lemon or lime, some mint and some simple syrup. And it's real fucking good. Highly recommend.
Not any industrial alcohol, though.
Yeah, don't stay away from that wood alcohol, whatever the fuck that shit is. It'll kill you. Yeah, wow. That story is going to rock me for some time. Like,
it's so fucked up.
I really want to see a picture of Wheeler. It's not going to make anything better, but like, he looked the worst?
He looked like a desk clerk. Like, he looked like he should be like an accountant or something. Man. He was really short. He was kind of balding and glasses and like just scrawny, bookish. Like,
man.
Yeah, he sucked.
Piece of shit.
Yeah.
Rest in piss. Adding him to it.
exactly. Yeah. Yeah, but that was quite a story. I'm glad that I don't have to talk about that ever again.
Yeah, it was a good one though. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. I guess bye.
Bye. Yeah, we'll see you again soon.
Yeah.
Bye, guys.
Thank you for listening to Beyond Reproach. Please note we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. A full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a written review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone who you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. And make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop on beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We also have exclusive content on Patreon where you can directly support the production of our show.